proceed with the appellant. And please state your name and appearance for the record. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Jacobs. With me today at council table, our lead counsel, Douglas Mancino.
Are you going to be using all the time this morning? You're the only one that's arguing.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
May I use, reserve 1 minute for rebuttal?
All right. Hopefully. We'll see.
Together, Mr. Mancino, Mr. Lobey, and I represent the appellant. By way of further introduction, I had the honor, Judge Seiler, of clerking for Judge Harry Welford on the Sixth Circuit before serving in the U.S. Department of Justice for 20 years.
He was a good judge.
He was an excellent judge.
Thank you. We always like to see our law clerks back. I'm always happy. But as law clerks know, they only win when they have the best facts. So that made the best facts and law win. So let's go ahead, and since you don't have a lot of time, let's jump into it.
And I just to finish.
I know you're Mr. Jacobs, so sometimes it might get confusing since you're the appellant and arguing for yourself, but we'll try to keep you straight.
To finish the thought, I was proud to appear in federal courts from Kentucky, where I had my first trial, to California, and to say that I represented the United States. I would not have been proud to represent the United States in this case.
Well, but let's jump right to Kenny, the standard of review here. It seems to direct the tax court to look at the commissioner's litigation position, not his position in the underlying administrative proceedings. How did the tax court err in looking at the commissioner's answer and determining that it was reasonable?
Kenny is not applicable to the facts of this case, Judge Callahan. There are a number of differences between Kenny and this case. In Kenny, the position of the petitioner and the petition of the IRS were different in the administrative proceeding than they were in the judicial proceeding. So when the petitioner got to the judicial proceeding, he did not allege something he alleged during the administrative proceeding. And when the IRS answered that petition, as a result, its answer was correct. And as we know from many cases under 7430, if the IRS correctly answers the petition, it sort of gets a free pass on 7430. Notwithstanding what, in terms of costs in the judicial proceeding, notwithstanding what happened in the administrative proceeding. And in this case, we have one consistent position by each party throughout the course of the two phases, the administrative proceeding, which lasted roughly 3 years, and the judicial proceeding, which lasted roughly 14 months.
Well, let me ask you about a different case, which is Bertolino, and how there we held that it was reasonable for the commissioner to go ahead and file an answer denying the claims before promptly attempting to settle. So how's your case any different?
Judge Thomas, entirely different for three or four reasons, Bertolino. The first reason was that this court found in Bertolino that the taxpayer had caused the problem in the first place by not calculating his alternative minimum tax. So the IRS then had to do it for him, and there was a dispute over what it should be, and when that went to the appeals officer, finally, which is to say that, again, the IRS is correct in its answer, when it denied, when it held by its statutory notice of deficiency. Okay. It was appropriate because the ATM hadn't been calculated. They got the number wrong. And then when it went to appeals, and this is another fundamental difference, okay, the answer is correct, and then it gets to appeals, and the appeals officer concedes at that point, okay, we calculated the number wrong. So you have the concession far earlier. You have an appropriate answer, I would argue, and you have a concession at an appropriate time. In this case, we have a completely boilerplate answer that denies the allegations in the petition, that asserts that the statutory notice of deficiency, which alleges that the that the petitioner, the taxpayer, owes some $17,500. The IRS stuck with its story.
Can you tell me? It seems like I'm not sure whether you have to show bad faith or that they didn't act in good faith, whatever, however you want to phrase that. Can you direct me to what you feel is the bad faith?
So we're going from the 7430 to 6673?
Well, just any bad faith in terms of, because obviously I think we've all reviewed the facts here, and we know when push comes to shove, it's like when you're on the eve of trial, then they give you everything you want. Okay, but up until that point, you weren't able to have a face-to-face. There are any number of things. So tell me what you think is the bad faith and how somehow it would compel a different result.
So I think the number one bad faith item in this case is that the statutory notices of deficiency that were ultimately issued were issued by the appeals team manager in LA, who had been removed from the case by the director of examination appeals 3 months before. The judge got that wrong. The tax court judge got that wrong. He said, mistakenly, plain error, I would argue. He said Mr. Guerrero, the new appeals officer, issued the statutory notices of deficiency. That's plainly wrong. You can look at the evidence. The notices are signed by issued by Mr. Matsuda, and the acting team manager, Mr. Haynes, initials them, signs for Matsuda. If you wonder, well, are they just using Matsuda's name, you go back to the case activity record, which is in the record, and you see that Mr. Matsuda goes into the file the day before the statutory notices of deficiency are issued, suggesting to me that he's accessing taxpayer records that he's not allowed to access because he's been removed from the case in November, and he's doing this at the end of January.
So removed, you asked to have him removed,
correct.
Right? So is that the same as, okay, so they remove him, they put someone else there. Is that the same as, say, when a judge is disqualified or recused and they can't, or is that a different process?
I see it in the same vein. I spent a lot of time at justice. If you're off a case, you're off a case. You don't start appearing in court, right? When you're off the case.
Well, I think there's some clear guidance for judges. You know, once we're gone on something, we don't then go back and tell the other judge what to do. But I'm not sure that I can find anything exactly similar to what in that situation.
I try not to say anything I can't prove. I can't prove that he set it all up at the last minute, but that's sure where the evidence takes me.
Is there something that you can point me to that says he has to have, like we say, the walls, or, you know, how we put up walls or recusals, is there anything that you can direct me to that says?
The types of rules that we have in the judiciary, the types of rules that we had at the Justice Department. And I think that's part of the problem with this case. They don't seem to have those rules at the IRS. It seems to be much more of a wild, wild west in terms of what they do. If I can back up, though, and supplement my answers to both your initial question, Judge Callahan, and yours, Judge Thomas, I think what the tax court did here, which was so egregious, was he takes a snapshot of what the IRS did, or as my students would say, a screenshot of what the IRS did on one day when they answered the complaint. And he says, the lawyer answering the complaint might have had a question or two or three to ask. And therefore, it was reasonable for them not to have conceded at that point in time. That's a fundamental error, especially under Ibrahim, where, if I might quote Your Honor, Judge Callahan, you wrote, quote, "The test for substantial justification is an inclusive one, whether the government's position as a whole has a reasonable basis in law and fact." Sorry, I got that wrong. In fact and law. And that's your separate opinion at 1188.
Let me ask you a question. When I say, did Mr. Jacobs, that meaning you, did you actually request Section 6673 fees from the tax court? And are you asking this court to award fees under 6673, or are you asking this court that we remand to the tax court with instructions to award 6673?
I'm sorry, did you finish?
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure that out.
We're asking that you remand to the tax court. Again, citing Ibrahim, the en banc opinion, the majority remanded with instructions to the district judge. And the instructions were, recalculate this under EJA, bad faith, and substantial justification.
So we have to, if we did remand it, is it required that we find that the commissioner proceeded in bad faith as a prerequisite to the
award?
No, it's a
great question, because I took a hard look at 6673. I think there is bad faith, and I answered your question. But all you really have to find is that the IRX vexatiously prolonged the litigation. It's a lighter standard, I think. And I think we satisfy it when the IRS, when the game is over. They've conceded and we send them the bill for $17,549 for the account and one legal consultation. And they say we're not paying it. And we say, why? And they say, because you didn't substantiate your deductions. And we say, but you have a 1,200-page record in a correspondence audit where it's customary to substantiate with paper. How can you say that? And then they invent this oral substantiation defense, which we find no precedent for in any court case, not even a tax court case.
So and that's when you're in overtime already, so I want to find out if my colleagues have any questions. Okay, so you're already almost 2 minutes over, but I'll give you 2 minutes for a rebuttal, okay?
Okay, may I cite one more case that
you can cite it, but don't talk about it.
Yes, ma'am. Lewis versus the United States, and this again goes back to the answer of what the standard is. Lewis versus the United States, in this court, 144 F3rd 1220, I'm embarrassed to say we didn't brief it, Harvard did in its amicus brief. And it stands also for the proposition that, and it's a tax court case, it stands for the proposition that the court looks at a whole at the conduct from start to finish. And that's what we're asking you to do, Your
Honor.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll go to the government at this point. Good morning.
Morning, Your Honors. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Can you hear him okay, Mr.
Yes.
Jacobs and everyone else? I think everyone can hear you, so that's good. And you can see him, right? Okay. We can all see you and we can hear you. All right, go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Isaac Rosenberg for the commissioner. When a taxpayer goes to the tax court over a deficiency dispute, it is irrelevant whether the IRS conducted a good and fair audit, unless and until the taxpayer seeks administrative costs under Section 7430A1. Otherwise, the tax court's only job is to decide whether the taxpayer owes additional taxes for the relevant tax years. And the tax court does that on the basis of a new record developed by the parties in the litigation, not on the basis of a record developed and available to the IRS, and makes that determination without any deference whatsoever to the IRS's judgments before the suit was filed.
Well, let's look, though, here as the premature notice of deficiency. It was sent to the wrong address. Is that evidence of bad faith on the part of the IRS?
No, Your Honor. And respectfully, bad faith is not a factor that the court considers under Section 7430. In this case, again, Mr. Jacobs did not seek any administrative costs. He only sought litigation costs. So the only position of the government of the United States that mattered in this case was the position taken by the commissioner in the court proceedings. And initially that position was that Mr. Jacobs owed the amounts of tax stated in the notice of deficiencies. The position was not that the IRS had conducted a good and fair audit. The position was not that the notices of deficiency were otherwise problematic.
But now, Mr. Rosenberg, what obligation does the commissioner's litigation counsel have to investigate the taxpayer's claims before filing an answer in tax court, if any?
Reasonable inquiry, and that's covered by the tax court rules. And forgive me, I don't remember which it is. It 34 is for petitions. I think answers might be 35. But it's the same sort of standard that applies to government counsel or any defense counsel in a civil case in federal court. It's reasonable inquiry. And what did chief counsel here do? She looked at the administrative file. She looked at the statutory notices of deficiency. She looked and saw that the examiners and the appeals officers involved in the case had found gaps in the information needed for Mr. Jacobs to substantiate his claimed deductions of business expenses above the line on Schedule C. It was his burden before the IRS to show his clear entitlement to take those deductions, and it was his burden under the tax court rules to show that he was entitled to those deductions.
Well, okay, so he consistently, Mr. Jacobs consistently asked for an in-person meeting, which he was never granted until July of 2018. When he finally meets in person, you know, that it's push, 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 that the IRS just won't give him a meeting, and then when finally your feet are to the fire and it's time to go to trial, then he gets everything that he wants. You try to give him half the baby and then he says, no, I'm, you know, so you have someone here, you know, the average person doesn't have the capabilities of Mr. Jacobs, let's face it. So you have someone that's going to hold your feet to the fire, and but you never give him in person, and then when you finally give him in person, then you throw up your hands and say, okay, you win. What are we to make of that?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I'm not sure that we would agree with that characterization of what happened.
Okay, tell me what happened then. Did you give him an in-person meeting? Is that impossible to get with the IRS?
No, of course it's not impossible. But understand that this started out and was, for its entirety, a correspondence audit conducted by mail. Typically, taxpayers do not get face-to-face interviews with the examiners. Those are the people who are looking at the documents submitted by the taxpayer and making the initial determination. Mr. Jacobs has cited the Internal Revenue Manual provision dealing with field exams and interviews. That provision of the Internal Revenue Manual is not the sort of published guidance that presumptively the IRS must follow to avoid an adverse finding under 7430. But in any event, that provision of the manual says that if a taxpayer requests an interview, one should be granted. It's not mandatory. It doesn't provide any guidepost for when under what circumstances it's discretionary.
Well,
when
it may not be discretionary. Let me ask you a question. At least one notice of rescission was set aside, a notice of deficiency in April, and the IRS gave him that. That wouldn't be enough to scare any taxpayer, and then it was rescinded, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
Okay.
So what about, I think another thing Mr. Jacobs complains about is that after the August 20th, 2019 in-person conference, it took the IRS until January 2020 to propose a settlement. In your view, was this a reasonable delay, and why did it take so long to propose a settlement?
Yes, we think objectively it was a reasonable delay. Nothing in the record speaks to why it took as long as it took. But understanding the complexion of the case leading up to the appeals conference and afterward, one might understand why this appeals officer would have wanted to be meticulous in analyzing the record and applying the appropriate authorities to make a recommendation that how it would have to be approved by his manager and then tendered to Mr.
Not
Jacobs.
Really. Would you characterize this as a big and complicated case? It just doesn't look like that to me. I mean, we get tax cases regularly, and we get, you know, Amazon and the IRS, we got all sort, and those are complicated. Here, it's just he's got claimed some expenses. You say we need more proof, and it just doesn't look that, it looks like it's something I might even be able to do. And I'm saying it doesn't look that hard. Is this a complicated case in your view?
The tax issues in the case are not complicated. And frankly, the facts, once we know what the facts are not complicated. What was complicated was how long it took to get the facts needed for Mr. Jacobs to substantiate his claimed business expenses. Why Mr. Jacobs was not able to put in writing over the many letters and memos that he submitted during the audits and the appeals proceedings, why he couldn't put in those written submissions what he was able to explain in person with Mr. Guerrero, I can't say, and I wouldn't want to speculate. But once those facts, which again are not complicated, were provided, Mr. Guerrero then wrote a very thorough, you know, 20-some-odd page report, settlement memo with tables, meticulously analyzing categories and species of expenses, the appropriate authorities, and making a recommendation. It wasn't a complete capitulation either. Mr. Guerrero agreed that 80%, roughly 80% of the claim deductions suffice, and that included items that he recommended settling based on the hazards of litigation.
Okay, so, but did Mr. Jacobs reject that and then say, okay, let's go? And then when it was time to go, then the IRS completely capitulated? Was the settlement less than what? I don't know. Am I reading the record wrong to say he got everything he asked for by pushing? Am I wrong, or?
When the IRS stipulated in the tax court, the IRS stipulated that he owed no additional taxes.
Okay.
The settlement recommendation made by Mr. Guerrero was a roughly 80% concession.
And he rejected that, right?
Mr. Jacobs never responded to it, or certainly didn't respond to it within, 4 to 5 months. And once there had been no action, despite correspondence from Mr. Guerrero and others, the case was returned for trial preparation because the case was in a holding pattern with the tax court, and the case needed to move forward. And Mr. Jacobs objected to that. But in any event, I'm not sure, and I don't want to speculate, and I don't want to put words in Mr. Jacobs' mouth, but I don't think that just conceding the deficiencies alone is what Mr. Jacobs intended to accomplish with the case. What he wanted to accomplish was to show that the audit itself was poorly conducted, that the notices of deficiency had been vindictively issued, and all of those allegations that were included in his petition, to the extent they were included in his petition, they were impertinent, and we objected to them on that basis. We didn't concede to those. We didn't admit to those. In Hoffman, the commissioner stipulated to judgment on the pleadings. That's the entire pleading, not specific allegations. So here, the only thing that the IRS conceded was that Mr. Jacobs didn't owe the taxes and the amounts of taxes stated in the notice of deficiency, and that was on the basis of information that he provided after the petition was filed. Access to the tax court is a little bit extraordinary in federal litigation because it's not an agency review case. There's no deference. You get a fresh crack at it, and you get to build a brand new record. You get to prove your case, and the tax court has the final and only say on whether you owe those taxes. Now, if you want to also challenge some wrongdoing or alleged wrongdoing that happened in the proceedings leading up to the notices of deficiency, there's a very easy way you do that, and you do what the taxpayer in Huffman did. You assert a claim for administrative costs in addition to litigation costs, and here Mr. Jacobs deliberately chose not to do that. He says why in his brief, and I'm sorry, I don't have this is page 13 of the blue brief, footnote 10. If he had done that and we had resisted, he could have recovered not only the administrative costs he had incurred, but also the costs incurred to litigate whether we had reasonably defended his administrative cost claim. And he had incurred at least some administrative costs that would have been recoverable, which included, I see I'm up against my time, but he incurred.
Okay, you go ahead.
In January of 2018, this is on page 393 of the excerpts of record, he incurred a legal fee, roughly an hour of consultation with a law firm after the administrative proceedings were underway. So he could have.
If I were to summarize your position, would it be that the IRS did not do anything wrong and that basically any delays were Mr. Jacobs' fault, and that ultimately the fact that the IRS on the eve of trial said, okay, we're not saying you have any taxes, he could be entitled to administrative fees, but that's not what he asked for, so abuse of discretion is the standard for the litigation fees, and therefore you win. Am I summarizing your position?
Sort of, but
do you think you did anything wrong?
Well, our first argument is that it doesn't matter. And our secondary argument, which we do explain in the red brief, is that an objectively reasonable person would have come away with the conclusion that we properly issued notices of deficiency because he hadn't substantiated his claim deductions when we did so. And in fact, the Internal Revenue Manual that talks about protecting the statute.
Well, okay, I'm a little bothered if you say if we did anything wrong, it doesn't matter. Does it really not matter if the government does anything wrong? Or are you saying it just doesn't legally matter? Or I'm not quite sure what. Sure. I mean, I, as a government employee myself, I feel like it does matter whether I get it right or wrong.
Right. And so for litigation costs, when we're looking at the position of the United States in the litigation, the position that the IRS took here was that Mr. Jacobs owed additional taxes. And in the tax court proceeding, That question was being decided all over again on the basis of a new record that the parties developed. And the tax court wasn't going to show any difference to the IRS's determinations or anything that happened in the proceedings. If Mr. Jacobs wanted to recover for the costs that he incurred in the administrative proceeding, there was a mechanism for him to do that, and he didn't. And he would have vindicated his challenge to the propriety of the audit by doing that. That was his choice. But 7430 is not a compensation statute. It's not a damages statute. It's supposed to ensure meaningful access to administrative processes and judicial processes to vindicate rights. And what right did Mr. Jacobs want vindicated, or what right did he have to vindicate in the judicial proceedings? It was his right not to owe additional taxes.
Okay, I think we've taken you over 2.5 minutes. So let me find out if my colleagues have any additional questions. They don't. So that'll conclude. Thank you for your argument. All right, Mr. Jacobs, you have 2 minutes.
A lot to cover in 2 minutes. I'll go quickly.
Well, we have 2 minutes, so yes, figure ma'am. It out.
So on the point of the IRS not having the information until the petition was filed, if I heard Mr. Rosenberg correctly, it's completely false. If you look at the record, the IRS had full documentation in May of 2018 with respect to the 2014 audit. In fact, the documentation was deemed by the appeals officer at the time to be too voluminous. And that's why she had actually scheduled a conference, and this is in the case activity report in the record. It's actually one of Mr. Rosenberg's documents that he submitted as an excerpt.
What's the most egregious thing that the IRS did to you that you'd like to have rectified here?
They would not talk to me, Judge Seiler. After 20 years in the government, I just wanted to sit down and tell them what they needed to hear and explain the material that they just refused to read. And that was that's the real problem with this case, is for 3 years, I gave them document after document. The 2014 audit substantiation, if you look at page 4 of our brief, footnote 2, we list, they had 23 single-spaced pages of briefs by September of 2018, because we had also supplemented the 2014 audit material with the 2015 audit material. They had everything they needed. As Mr. Rosenberg says, it was a correspondence audit, meaning they don't talk to you. So we explained over and over again in correspondence, in briefs. We put together labeled exhibit packages well beyond, Judge Callahan, to your point, that a normal taxpayer would do.
Okay.
We put together
Let me just direct you one area. If, let's just say hypothetically, and I'm not saying we haven't conferenced on this case, this is a hypothetical. If we agreed with you and said you were entitled to litigate, that there was an abuse of discretion, is there any dispute as to the amount of the fees? Was that disputed down below, or does it have to go back to be determined?
I'm afraid that piece has to be determined by the tax court judge because he didn't get to it.
Okay.
We submitted our bill.
Okay, that's what I need to know. So you're over on
we
that.
We wouldn't expect you to slog through the numbers.
Okay, you answered my question. Okay, thank you both for your argument. This matter will stand submitted.